This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 44 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be exploring the concept of perfection, both in terms of the Borg and in the history of philosophy. Zachary, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. I'd like to say I'm doing perfectly tonight, given the subject matter. In fact, you can just call me Mr. Perfect.
Mr. Perfect for this episode. So, Zachary, we were discussing the topic earlier this week, and while I'm excited to be talking about the Borg and this concept of perfection, I know you've got a really interesting angle that you wanted to go at this topic with. So, shall we dive right in?
Absolutely. Well, you know me, I'm a Voyager fan, and Voyager is my favorite Star Trek show. A lot of people know that, some people don't. And I'd recently rewatched The Omega Directive, which is not one of my favorite episodes of Voyager, but I happened to have caught it on a rewatch. And it occurred to me as I was watching it that the concept of perfection plays an important role, obviously for the Borg in that episode, but in the history of philosophy, the concept of perfection and whatever it entails plays an important role in various key arguments in the history of philosophy. Things like the ontological argument to try to prove God's existence, things like St. Thomas Aquinas's five ways of proving God's existence for the argument from degree. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it would be interesting just to kind of, you know, juxtapose what perfection means to the Borg versus what role perfection plays in these important arguments in the history of philosophy, especially given that the angle that the episode, the Omega Directive takes with perfection is that the Borg, view perfection as having some sort of a spiritual component. Mm-hmm. It's not just like an abstract goal for them. There's kind of this reverence around this molecule that for them is a symbol of perfection. So given the role that perfection plays for the Borg in the episode The Omega Directive, and given the role that perfection plays in the history of philosophy and these important arguments to try to prove God's existence, and given that the concept of perfection seems to have some sort of a spiritual component for the Borg, symbolized by this molecule that they revere, the Omega molecule, I thought it would be interesting just to put all those together into a conversation and see what we can come up with.
Yeah, I think that it's the quest itself that really intrigues me. When we first meet the Borg in The Next Generation, they're more or less space zombies. I mean, they're mindless zombies that just wander around assimilating everything in sight. And we really don't understand what their purpose or what their mission is. Again, it almost seems mindless, but I think for me, it was first contact when I think we really fleshed out the Borg in terms of what their quest is, what it is they're trying to attain, what it is they're trying to achieve. Certainly the Omega Directive. I think we'll probably try to slide a little first contact in there because, again, I think we gain an understanding of their quest and certainly what's on the Queen's mind in terms of that desire to attain perfection.
I think it would be interesting to compare and contrast the Borg obsession with perfection versus the human obsession with perfection. And this is something I think not every human has this quality to be striving after improving him or herself, or striving towards, you know, this inevitable or this impossible thing to strive after, perfection. But I think in general, humans tend to obsess over things they don't have, right? If you're mortal, you're going to obsess over things that are immortal, that live forever, eternal. If you are not a moral person, you're going to be obsessed with the idea of being a more moral person, an omnibenevolent person. And so these quasi-religious concepts of omnipotence and omnibenevolence and perfection, the things we usually associate with deity, are things that humans don't have. We have them in a lesser degree. And I think it just speaks to our failures and limitations as humans. You know, we don't have those qualities to the greatest degree. Oftentimes we wish we had them more and we don't. And so it's something that we strive after. And the Borg, I think, are on a similar kind of process-based quest, right? They don't have perfection. You know, they think they're closer to it than anyone, of course, but they're striving for perfection just like humans are striving for perfection. I think that perfection means something very different for humans versus the Borg, but there is the striving in common that the humans and the Borg share in Star Trek.
I think to some degree, Zachary, every human strives for some level of perfection in some area of their life. And this goes way beyond sort of that atypical perfectionist thinking. For some, it might be their body image. Certainly, if we look at the plastic surgery industry, the supplement industry, the skin product industry, these industries are booming because human beings, by and large, are trying to find that fountain of youth. They're trying to sculpt their bodies into whatever the vision of perfection is at that particular time. We've got you know, little girls who are, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old that are just worried sick to death about whether or not they have a thigh gap and, you know, how large this is or how small that is. And so this starts at a very young age, and that pressure, I think about, you know, boys again in that same age range are starting to worry about, you know, bulking up their muscles. And so, you know, the industry for things like muscle milk and supplements and nutrients and all of this kind of and health products, bodybuilding and exercise products, these industries are booming because human beings are on a quest for perfection. And for those that aren't as worried, perhaps maybe about their body image, they're striving for some level of perfection in another area. You know, it might be an academic perfection. I certainly know people who are just so driven for this academic perfection. They're trying to attain a degree and be number one in their field, and they're going after it at the cost of everything else. And we see these kind of strivings perhaps in neighbors and friends and people around us. So I think all of us, to some degree or another, are striving for some level of perfection in one area or another.
I think maybe this is something that comes with age and experience, and maybe after having experienced a few failures. You know, I used to be an academic. At a certain point, I realized I was a better teacher than an academic. Then I used to be a teacher. Then I realized it's really hard to make a living teaching, and I wasn't able to do that to the degree that I wanted to do it. And you know, there are sort of failures associated with each of them. I don't even call them failures. They were largely successes, but they didn't sort of pan out the way I'd intended at the time. So, you know, I think being comfortable with your own limitations and being comfortable with the fact that, you know, perfection is not something you can attain in any one of those fields, you know, probably comes with experience. And if you don't have that, you have something like hubris. And the Borg are really guilty of this. You know, they have failed to realize their own limitations. They've taken this concept of perfection, they've taken it to the nth degree, and they have this sort of arrogance associated with their quest for perfection that is very much like what you would get with the things you just mentioned. Someone who's on a quest for academic perfection or for physical perfection or for any one of these, but mm-hmm. failed to realize their own limitations, failed to realize their own humility, and it's just hubris run rampant, and it can be really self-destructive. It can damage relationships. So I think largely the quest for perfection is futile, you know, to use a pardon the pun, you know, perfection is futile. Tell that to Seven of Nine. And I think it breeds arrogance and doesn't breed humility. So I don't think of it as very virtuous, although, you know, this is something that, you know, if you look at it from a theological standpoint and in the history of philosophy, this is where perfection comes up, right? Because we tend to imbue a deity with having these qualities. You know, I'm not omnibenevolent. I'm good, but I'm not perfect. And God is the one who's omnibenevolent. And I have some power to affect the things around me, but I'm not all powerful. I don't have omnipotence. I have some knowledge, but I'm not omniscient. I don't know everything, right? So these are qualities we tend to associate with a deity. And I think it's just no accident that when you're talking about perfection, you have to talk about this more theological view. Because if you don't have something like that, you're just going to reject the concept outright. I think if you reject the concept of theology and divinity and whatnot, perfection is not going to interest you. And I think when I was teaching philosophy, this is something I had a really hard time motivating people to care about, because if you're not interested in the divine or in the concept of perfection, these arguments involving the concept of perfection seem really abstract and really don't seem to have any practical import. And I love that something that really comes up only in theology, in the areas of philosophy known as philosophy of religion or philosophy of theology, that's where the concept of perfection comes up. So, but here we are, you know, with a species like the Borg in Star Trek that are obsessed with perfection. Turns out they have some sort of a spiritual quest. So I don't really want to turn the discussion into a discussion about the divine per se, but in the history of philosophy, that's where the concept of perfection comes up. The divine having these infinite attributes that we don't have, and you know, we lesser humans having these attributes to lower degrees. And, so in my mind, the Borg quest for perfection is interesting, and largely because it has this, you know, spiritual component. And I guess I don't even care about the spiritual component so much, because, you know, what philosophers try to do with the concept of perfection when they're talking about God, like, it mostly comes up in the attempts to prove God's existence. You know, they don't care so much about the spiritual quest to be more perfect, but they care about analyzing the concept of perfection and seeing what you can discern from analyzing the concept itself. And, you know, in that case, they're trying to prove God's existence, and the Borg are trying to do something slightly different with it. You know, they're not trying to prove a deity, they're trying to become more perfect. But, you know, it's in analyzing the concept of perfection itself that all the philosophical work is done. So, what conclusion can I draw from that? I don't really know. I think it's interesting that there is this parallel in between, you know, we limited humans who quest after things like perfection and the divine, and the Borg who are, you know, they might think of themselves as being close to perfection, but, you know, the you know, members of Starfleet and the Federation obviously see the flaws in the Borg's a quest for perfection. But the Borg have this hubris, very much in line with what you just described, you know, going on this quest for perfection that's largely futile and largely, not something that is able to be fulfilled. And they end up, you know, doing some really destructive things all in the name of perfection. And I think there's a lot of, you can point to a lot of instances in the history of religion, the history of theology, where really terrible things have been done in the name of something good, in the name of a quest to achieve something great. And so in that sense, I think of the Borg as a good metaphor for the failures of religion and the failures failure of bad religion, people doing bad things in the name of religion.
Sure. You're tying a lot to the theological aspects, and I'm not pushing back, and and I certainly don't want to conflate anything, but I do want to say that while there are certainly some theological aspects to this idea of a quest for perfection, largely in the Star Trek universe, which again by and large is a humanistic approach to that quest, we see it quite rampant in the Federation. This idea that, as Jean-Luc Picard put it, we, you know, we're working towards the benefit and advancement of
humanity.
Yeah,
we work to better ourselves, and right? That's what he said.
To better ourselves, certainly. So, by and large, the Federation is on a quest for perfection, and it has nothing really to do with theology. And I don't want to conflate that, but it's not really rooted in this kind of theological pursuit of God, but rather for the benefit and advancement of self, of species.
And I think in the history of philosophy, where the concept of perfection comes into play, it's the measuring rod by which you measure these various degrees. If we're improving ourselves, if we're getting better in some degree, goes the typical arguments in the history of philosophy. There has to be some greatest degree of that, some measure by which these lower degrees get defined or get determined. So if it makes sense to say we're getting better, then there has to be a best. There has to be something that we're striving towards mm-hmm. that defines the gradations of better in the first place. And that's true of knowledge. It's true of ethics. It's true of your ability to influence. And I'm thinking in terms of power and in terms of the divine, it would be something like omnipotence, the greatest possible power. But these arguments in the history of philosophy basically fundamentally boil down to the fact that if you have gradations of anything, then there has to be some maximum degree. Otherwise, the whole concept of gradations doesn't even make sense, goes the argument. And we'll spell that out a little bit later in the show when we talk about the actual arguments. But, is that good reasoning or not? I think largely most contemporary philosophers reject that kind of reasoning for a few reasons that we can talk about. But, I guess whether or not we're talking about religion and theology, I think you can ask the more abstract question. If humanity is on this humanistic quest to better itself, and whatever that means, whatever attributes we could spell that out in terms of, it would be interesting to kind of spell that out. What attributes really do define the betterment of humanity? And you can talk about some ethical attributes or some political attributes or some tolerance attributes, whatever, these things that are well-known attributes of the Federation and Starfleet worldview. Does it make sense to think about a greatest possible degree of those? Is there some end state that striving is towards, or is it this ongoing quest? And I think arguably our position now it would be that it's an ongoing quest. In fact, in Star Trek Beyond, which just got released, which had its home release a couple days ago, Captain Kirk mm-hmm. basically says as much, that the quest goes on given the endless vastness of space. Aren't we on a quest that fundamentally has no end? In other words, does the quest even need that greatest possible degree to be striving towards? And in the history of philosophy and theology, that concept of perfection defined the end state, the goal towards which you were striving. It defined all the degrees that measured out your improvement along those gradations. But if space is vast and there's no end to the quest, do we need this concept of perfection at all to justify the quest for betterment in the first place? I think arguably the Star Trek position is ultimately, no, you don't need that end state. It's all about the quest, and the betterment doesn't need a final state or an end goal. You can define those gradations in other ways besides specifying this maximum, ideal, largely theoretical end state or the greatest degree of any of those gradations of betterment.
In Christian theology, it is a quest to be more Christ-like, Jesus Christ being the standard. So for the Christian, it is a process we refer to as discipleship. That word disciple is rooted in the word discipline. So it is a discipline, a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, lifelong advancement in a discipline to be more like Christ, who, by the way, in Christian theology, we refer to him as the God-man. He is 100% God and yet 100% man. So the quest, to some degree, almost seems futile because he had something that in Christian theology we as human beings don't have, and that is divinity. We don't have that spark of divinity. So it almost seems like a futile quest, and yet we still progress in the discipline of discipleship.
So this is interesting because I think we're starting to spell out a kind of taxonomy of different varieties of the concept of perfection, different definitions. On the Christian worldview that you just mentioned, it's largely being Christ-like or being God-like, Christ mm-hmm. being the ideal person, the ideal man, right? And, okay, that's one definition of perfection. Take all these attributes of God, come to life through Christ, and our goal as humans is to try to become that. However much we might fail, that's still the goal. And I think that's an interesting tension in the Christian worldview. It's still the goal, even though we're kind of doomed to failure and never able to quite try to achieve
it.
I think that's an interesting paradox. if you take the more humanistic Star Trek worldview, we're on this quest to better ourselves. I think there's an open question. Well, what is the goal? What is the striving? What are we striving to become? And I think all you can do is kind of spell out the attributes. And again, I think these aren't a surprise. I think the attributes are increasing our knowledge. The attributes are, you know, making ourselves better ethical people, whatever that means. Not violating things like the Prime Directive, forming good political relationships, and seeking unity in some political sense with the aliens that you encounter. And these are just attributes of the quest. For the Borg, now this is an interesting question. What does perfection mean for the Borg? I understand the Christian worldview. I understand the humanistic Star Trek worldview. What are the attributes of perfection that the Borg are seeking after? Because the Borg, they'll just talk about perfection. Like Seven of Nine in Voyager basically throws out around the word perfection, right? We're on this quest for perfection and, you know, all the things she has to say about it. But what exactly does that mean for the Borg? Can we make any progress at all in spelling out what attributes that perfection has inside the collective mind of the Borg?
Well, according to Q Jr., she's already achieved Borg perfection.
Well, that's undeniable. I'll grant you that. And some human perfection too. Right?
Indeed.
Possibly some aesthetic perfection comes into play.
The lily and the rose, my friend, the lily and the rose.
No, so I'm sure. So what are the things that would define Borg perfection? Is it an infinitely fast transference of information amongst the collective? Is it, an infinite number of species being assimilated? What are the metrics of this perfection for the Borg?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to end up jumping ahead at some point here in our discussion, because my mind is going about a million miles an hour at this point. The thing about what the Borg are trying to obtain, I don't think that's ever really spelled out in the Star Trek universe, but what they are doing in order to try to attain that perfection, they are going out and they are assimilating into their collective imperfect beings. So, quite frankly, Zachary, I don't think the mathematics will ever add up for them. The mathematical idea of adding imperfection to their collective is only going to breed more imperfection. It doesn't really add up to perfection at any point here. So, in my mind, what they're trying to do in order to attain that perfection is flawed. And it's really not so much different than the Federation going out and bringing into the fold other worlds to try and further the Federation or to further Starfleet. There's the Borg and the Federation are not that much different.
Well, that's an interesting metaphor. It's almost like adding two numbers trying to reach infinity. 2 + 1 = 3 + 1 = 4 + 1 = 5. You know, can you ever reach infinity by doing that? And the mathematics of infinite numbers is actually quite interesting, and we're totally not going to do that justice here today. Partly because I don't know enough about it to really do it justice, other than to know about it. But you're right. There's something kind of specious about the methods the Borg are using to achieve this perfection. And Mike, you mentioned Star Trek First Contact. And what I find fascinating about that movie is there's a scene in which Data basically calls bullshit to the Borg Queen about this quest for perfection. Mm-hmm. He basically points out the fact that her motives are not necessarily sincere, that there's this talk of perfection and bettering themselves. And, you know, the rhetoric that the Borg will say, you know, assimilating you for the sake of integrating you into the collective so we can be, achieve perfection. Data basically recognizes the fact that this is largely power-based. And this kind of quest, inauthentic quest for perfection is very much in line with what I would expect from someone like Michel Foucault, the French philosopher who really wanted to conflate the concepts of knowledge and power, that anytime there's a system of knowledge, there's a power structure that lets that piece of knowledge come to fruition. Mm-hmm. And you, in the Borg collective, you've got a power structure. You've got the Borg queen, you've got the Borg drones. And this quest for perfection is not a pure quest for the Borg. However much Seven of Nine seems to revere the concept of perfection, I think largely you can take the other side of the coin, Data's perspective, and just call bullshit and say, this quest for perfection is not a pure motivation. It's largely done for totalitarian power-based reasons. It has nothing to do with this, you know, more pure spiritual reverence for the concept of perfection in itself.
And in that regard, I agree 100% with Mr. Data. I think it's fascinating because when we look at the Omega Directive, this idea that this molecule to the Borg represents, I think, Zachary, to go back to the original question, this molecule for some reason represents what the Borg are trying to attain. I don't think I'm reading anything or speaking anything that really wasn't kind of brought out. This really is, this is the Holy Grail of the Borg, this molecule. And what's really fascinating is Catherine Janeway really opposes Seven of Nine, and she says to her, listen, the final frontier has some boundaries that shouldn't be crossed, and we're looking at one. So really, to some degree, Catherine Janeway is saying, you know, listen, this quest for perfection, this, you're trying to attain something that is unattainable. It's completely unattainable. So, you know, again, that raises the question. So what, first of all, what is it that the Borg were trying to, what is it that they're trying to attain? And are there boundaries even in our own quest that shouldn't be crossed?
Well, I think I'm fascinated by the religious, you know, I would say religious, quasi-religious symbolism of this molecule as a symbol for perfection in the Borg. And as you were talking, I was thinking about other religious symbols. Like, you and I, you know, share a largely, you know, Judeo-Christian worldview in which, on a Christian worldview, there's a symbol like the cross, right? That symbolizes it. It's not like every Christian is going out there wanting to crucify themselves, right? That's not what that symbol means. It's a symbol for something they believe in, something they strive for. It's rich with meaning. And I kind of want to ask the same questions about this Omega molecule. What role does it play? It can't be that the Borg really want to destroy subspace, right? So it's not this literal. It's not that the Omega molecule itself is the goal, right? It's a symbol for perfection for them, whatever that means. Am I right that this molecule is just a symbol largely? I mean, it's not about the molecule in itself. And if that is, I think it's even less plausible. I think, you know, why is something as naturalistic and as arbitrary as the next, you know, the next molecule in the periodic table? Or the next, you know, is it a molecule or an atom?
It's a molecule.
It's a molecule.
The Borg refer to it. Their designation is particle 010.
Okay, naturally.
But it is. It's not particle 001. A molecule. They refer to it as the Omega molecule in the episode. But here's the thing. You and I were talking in the turbo lift about it, at least in the Christian world, these metaphors that we have for virtually every experience that we have in our daily lives as disciples of Christianity, of disciples of Christ. And almost to that degree, the Omega molecule really is a metaphor. Seven of Nine says that they were instructed to assimilate it at all costs. So no number of drones, no loss of life, nothing is sacred when it comes to trying to attain this. So that they will lay down the entire Borg collective if necessary in order to assimilate it. And she says that it is perfection. The molecules exist in a flawless state, infinite parts functioning as one. And it really is, to some degree, a metaphor for what I think the Borg are trying to attain, and that is infinite, unlimited, so they're not going to stop until they've assimilated every culture, every species, infinite parts functioning as one.
And I guess I just don't it seems like this is just radically out of proportion. You know, a molecule, however complex it is is still a tiny little thing in the universe. So it amounts to like demolishing New York City to save an anthill or something. It's like, it just, the proportions don't make sense to me. Why this molecule, and you know, what attributes does this molecule have? Yes, it's beautiful, it's symmetric, it's complex, but why does that mean perfection or infinity? I guess that's the thing. I just don't understand why this molecule is imbued with those qualities. A molecule in any, almost any measure, what does it mean for a molecule to be perfect? What does it mean for a molecule to be infinite? What does it mean for a molecule to have any other of these qualities we've talked about that are, you know, quasi-religious or divine in nature? I just don't understand. It's like, it's like these mythical tales, like, you know, the Holy Grail, right? How can this object have these magical properties, right? It just doesn't make sense to me. So, you know, however complex it is and however much power is contained inside this molecule, why does it have these greatest degree type qualities, perfection and infinity? I just don't understand the reasoning process. And that's part of the reason the episode never worked for me. I just never bought the premise of the episode.
Well, again, I think the metaphor there, that this molecule, or these molecules rather, existing in a flawless state, infinite parts functioning as one. I think this is a picture of just as when you walk into a lot of Christian churches, somewhere in the church is going to be a picture of Jesus. And it's almost as though they are saying, this is what we are all striving to attain. Which is kind of sad because they're all artist renditions. Nobody knows what he looked like. I'm not so concerned with what he looks, but rather on the pages of a book, I can read about his acts, and that's what I'm chasing after. But nevertheless, we put his picture up as though this is, you know, as somewhere in some Borg infrastructure is a picture of the Omega molecule, or at least some artist's rendition of what they think the Omega molecule might look like.
Right.
And Borg walk by it day in and day out. They look up at it and they go, wow.
Well, and maybe Mike, I'm just being too literal here. I mean, the example you just mentioned, the picture of Jesus in a church, no one thinks the picture or the representation, the sure. visual symbol, has any of the attributes that Jesus has claimed to have, right?
Sure.
Likewise, you know, it's certainly possible that the Borg, if this molecule plays some symbolic role for them, that the symbol they've chosen doesn't have any of the attributes that they're reading into it that they want to achieve. It's just purely symbolic. It's something to... and then it's interesting to ask, what role does the symbol play? Does the symbol orient your orientation? I think, you know, the role of symbols in religion is important because it gives you something to strive for. It's a reminder of the things that you think are important that you want to strive for. You know, I mean, that's a great question, Mike. Do the Borg hang pictures of the Omega molecule inside their alcoves? Do they, you know, take it out on Sundays and, you know, have some sort of a service? What do they do? Largely in human religions, these symbols are ritualistic, right? They get taken out in certain times. We have certain actions around them. I'd like to see what rituals the Borg have cultivated around the Omega molecule. That's an interesting question.
Well, I'm sure that they have, you know, for instance, ritual passion plays in which they depict the assimilation of the Omega molecule.
We might actually be veering into the absurd now. So.
We've gone past the absurd. But here's the thing. 7 of 9 in this episode, Zachary, we're almost cheering for her because she is so sincere. And this does become a matter of faith for her. This is something that she has a spiritual connection to. This, in some ways, represents God to her. So we cheer for her to make that connection to this God particle. And I don't use that by accident, because I want to talk about the God particle here in a little bit. But she has this spiritual connection to it, and we're almost cheering for her. And, you know, Janeway is there to kind of, you know, squelch that. But I think for the Borg, this isn't a sincere spiritual journey, at least in terms of the Queen, because the Queen refers to herself. Let's remember, Zachary, the Queen often refers to herself as the one who brings order to chaos. So really, this is a power trip for her. Back to your comment about Data. Data is exactly right. This is a power trip for her. This has nothing to do with a spiritual quest. This is a destructively powerful molecule. And if it falls into the wrong hands, God have mercy. And Janeway recognizes that. Janeway understands that. The Federation understands that. Starfleet understands that. And that's why they have the Omega Directive. We've got to do whatever we can to make sure that this particle doesn't end up in the wrong hands. And Seven's fighting her on this. You know, you Starfleet types, you destroy what you don't understand. And is Seven of Nine right? Yeah. Is Janeway right? Yeah. So, you know, here they are kind of butting heads in this episode. But again, for the Borg Queen, this particle represents ultimate power. Yeah, she's going to sacrifice every drone she has in order to assimilate it because of its destructive power.
You know, it reminds me a lot of the Spanish Inquisition, frankly. You know, it's like Ponce de Leon going out looking for the Fountain of Youth. It's mm-hmm. like it's like this quest for gold, right? It's just I guess my point is I don't cheer Seven of Nine on in this episode. I actually feel a little bit sorry for her. You know, she's chosen to strive after something that is inherently kind of almost by definition impossible. She's, you know, the symbol that the Borg use is this really harmful, destructive symbol that can cause a lot of damage, just like the Spanish Inquisition. I don't see anything to cheer her on about, frankly. I think she's chosen the wrong symbol, the wrong quest. She's on a self-defeating, impossible quest that will lead to probably nothing good at the end of the day.
Mm. I admire the fact that moment when she gets to look at the Omega particle. She's managed to control it for just the briefest second. And in that moment, she, to some degree, is looking into the face of her God. And so for me, it's a little allegorical, and that's probably my connection to it. And that's why I cheer on, because I attribute that to some degree with, you know, what an incredible thing it would be to look into the face of my God. And
well, what, when Seven of Nine is able to observe the Omega molecule, she sits down over a cup of coffee with Tom Paris and talks about what it's like to achieve warp 10.
True. But you talked about the Spanish Inquisition. And so I think this quest for Omega, this quest for perfection for the Borg, is something very, very destructive. And it does parallel some very dark pages in the history of the Christian church. I'm thinking of, for instance, the Crusades, in which, you know, thousands of innocents were slaughtered, really, by the Christian church, by the Crusaders, who were trying to protect, or at least their premise was they were trying to perfect the Holy Land and trying to protect these holy relics, the Holy Grail, things like the Ark of the Covenant, these Christian treasures, if you will, and to try to keep them from falling into the hands of the Muslims. And so in their quest to try and stop the Muslims from gaining control of the Holy Land, getting their hands on these relics, quite frankly, they slaughtered thousands of Jews in that pursuit. People who really didn't have, as it were, a dog in the hunt, as they say, fell to the sword of the Crusaders. It's a very, very dark chapter in the history of the church. And by the way, these were sanctioned holy wars, if you will, that were sanctioned by Rome, by the Pope, by the Church, and very, very dark chapters in which I think we see a real picture of what the Borg represent in their quest to assimilate cultures and all of this in their, you know, quote-unquote quasi pursuit of perfection.
This is an interesting example because I think it's a case where any different reading you come up with, these different readings can all be true at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, one reading of this is that there were sincere believers who thought they were doing the right yes. thing. However much we look back now and say that was evil, that was bad, that was whatever, right? Another way of reading it is that despite the presence of sincere believers doing what they thought was right, you know, someone was wielding the power and, you know, pulling the strings, mm-hmm. sending people out to do whatever. And it was largely political and power based, and they knew better even then. That's another reading of it. Another reading of it is that a lot of this is informed by a worldview that's in the background that we just don't understand now, right? That our modern, more scientific worldview has rendered us unable to understand the worldview of someone from a few hundred years ago without the benefit of the modern period and the modern concepts and modern ways of analyzing things. And so all of these readings are probably true at the same time, and I find that fascinating. So as you apply that to the Borg, you can say, well, look, there probably are a bunch of ordinary Borg drone believers who have faith in the Omega molecule, right? And then there's the Borg queen pulling the strings. And for her, it's largely this Foucauldian reading where, you know, it's largely power-based and it's very insincere. And she's built this power structure and, you know, reinforced this power structure using the Omega molecule as a symbol. And it's all power-based and not very sincere, probably. And it's largely structural, given the Borg collective consciousness. You know, a lot of this isn't the result of any one person's thinking. It's kind of something that emerged out of the collective consciousness and this collective quest for perfection. How it got tied up with the Omega molecule, again, I kind of have no idea. It still doesn't really make sense to me. But it's fascinating to kind of get, you know, use the Borg quest for the Omega molecule and something like the Christian Crusades and do a comparative analysis. You know, where are they similar? Where are they different? I think they're largely similar. I think, you know, as we've cut it up here, That analogy holds pretty well in terms of the various readings you can give of that situation.
Zachary, I know you've mentioned Foucault a couple times. Do you want to talk a little bit about at least perfection as it relates to the history of philosophy?
Yeah, I feel like I would be remiss if we didn't talk about these classic arguments in the history of philosophy revolving around the concept of perfection a little bit. Although, again, this is one of these things where I feel like in philosophy classes, a lot of times these arguments are handed out there largely as red herrings for students to pick apart and figure out what's wrong with the reasoning. And if you don't have kind of this Judeo-Christian worldview where the concept of perfection means something to you theologically, you won't be terribly motivated by the reasoning. But nonetheless, historically, these arguments are very important in the history of philosophy. You know, any undergraduate, you know, intro to philosophy class would at least mention these, if not spend some time on them. And so insofar as this is a Star Trek and philosophy podcast, we should spend a little time on them as well. And it's interesting to kind of parallel the reasoning. You know, I can, in the back of my mind, as I run through these arguments, I want to be thinking, you know, what do these arguments mean in the Star Trek world? You know, would the Borg give similar kinds of arguments? Would the Federation and its quest for betterment give similar kinds of arguments? I don't know the answers to that question. It's something we can talk about after we mention what the arguments are. But the two arguments that come to mind are what's known as the ontological argument. And ontos is the Greek word for being. And so the ontological argument tries to conclude that God exists based on the definition of the concept itself. So the reasoning usually goes something like this. Imagine the most perfect being. And in the term in Latin, which is, it's an interesting term, is ens perfectissimum, not just perfect being, but the most perfect being, the most perfect being possible. Whatever that is, kind of have that concept in your mind. Now ask yourself, okay, what kind of attributes would that being have? Well, it would be things like omnibenevolent and omniscient and omnipotent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all the omnis, right? and then you ask, goes the reasoning, you ask yourself, what would you say if it came down to a question of whether this being existed or doesn't exist? Does this being exist or not? Wouldn't the being be more perfect if it had all of those qualities and existed versus having all those qualities and not existing, if it were merely hypothetical? And so, you know, goes the reasoning, you're supposed to kind of say, well, yeah, a being that really did have all those properties would be better, would be more perfect than a being that didn't really have all of those qualities, a purely hypothetical concept, an abstract, non-existing being. So kind of this is the weird move in the argument. By definition, a most perfect being has to exist. Existence is one of the attributes, a necessary attribute of the most perfect being. And this is one of these things that, to my mind, it just sounds like a like philosophical sleight of hand. Like, wait a minute, you can't define something into existence, right? And that's the main criticism of the argument is that you kind of like, wait a minute, existence is not an attribute of something, you know, it doesn't add anything substantive to the definition of the being. But, you know, this is an interesting attempt to kind of prove God's existence. And the argument was really first formulated by the philosopher Saint Anselm. And immediately there was a criticism that was given back. And it's an interesting criticism that you can use this to prove the existence of anything. Like let's do a Star Trek counterexample. Let's suppose I have in my mind the most perfect planet, more perfect than Risa.
More perfect than Risa?
The most perfect planet possible. Well, what attributes would it have? Well, it would have a lot of Jamaharan. It would have a pretty ocean sunset. It would have all the things that a most perfect planet would have. Now what about a planet that existed versus doesn't exist? Yeah, obviously, if that planet existed, it would be more perfect than the planet that doesn't. So by definition, the most perfect planet has to exist. And you go, wait a minute, there's something really, really wrong with that reasoning. It leads to absurd consequences. We don't think the most perfect planet exists by definition. And part of the difference there might be that this is not just the most perfect something, but the most perfect being in general, the most perfect anything that might make this argument work. But that's kind of the original source of how the concept of perfection came to play a role in philosophy, these kinds of arguments of analyzing the concept of perfection. And so that's an interesting question. If you take the concept of perfection, spell out, this is why I was trying to push us the direction of spelling out what perfection mean for the Borg. Because on the Judeo-Christian worldview, the concept of perfection means things like being omniscient and omnibenevolent and all powerful and all the omnis that we talked about. So what does it mean for the Borg? What was their definition of perfection? And what consequences can you draw from it? You know, in this argument, the ontological argument, the idea is that you can learn something really interesting from the concept of perfection. If this were a good argument, and again, I think there's a lot that's really wrong with this argument. I don't think existence is a property of something. I don't think you need degrees. I'm skeptical even that the concept of perfection is a substantive concept in the first place. So there's a lot that I find wrong with it. But goes the argument, you can, if you take the concept of perfection, analyze it, you can learn something really interesting from the concepts that go into the concept of perfection, all the omnis. And if existence is one of the attributes of perfection, that's a really interesting insight, because that would mean, by definition, a most perfect being has to exist. You know, it's part of the definition of the being. So, what does that mean for the Borg? You know, can we learn anything interesting from, draw any interesting conclusions from the concept of perfection from the Borg? And again, I just don't really know what it means for the Borg. I feel like we're just not given enough evidence in universe. I feel like I have Data's perspective. Like, I'm skeptical of this quest for perfection. I don't find it sincere. I don't find it very substantive. It's largely power-based. I suspect there's no there to coin a phrase. So that's one argument, the ontological argument. And the other argument that came to mind is yet another attempt to try to prove God's existence. And again, I have to kind of put in parentheses, if you're not motivated by the quest to try to figure out whether God exists or not, these arguments aren't going to be very interesting to you. And, but nonetheless, I think, you know, the insight we had at the beginning of the show, which is that the Borg are on this quest to better themselves in their own mind, however insincere it is. We humans are on a quest to better ourselves in various ways in universe or here in the real universe. So, you know, even if you reject the sort of religious, you know, theological interpretation of perfection, the concept of improvement and what we're striving for and how that concept can orient our behavior towards trying to improve ourselves, I think there's still something valuable there, even if you reject the theological interpretation. But the fact of the matter is, in the history of philosophy, where the concept of perfection matters the most in terms of these key arguments that everyone keeps remembering and pointing to are these quasi-religious philosophy of religion kind of arguments.
Sure.
So I feel like I need to justify that when we're talking about Star Trek a little bit. Like, why are we talking about this? Well, because that's just how philosophy happened.
Yeah.
And it is what it is, right? So the other argument that's important in the history of philosophy is one of Aquinas's five ways. He had five different sort of proofs, in irony quotes, attempts to try to deduce or conclude the existence of God. One of them is known as the argument from degree. And we've actually kind of already spelled out this argument a little bit. We haven't called it, we haven't named it, we haven't said who described it. But basically, the argument goes something like this. The fact we, if we look around the world, we can see that there are degrees in things. Some creatures have more or less knowledge. Some creatures have more or less power. Mm-hmm. Some creatures have more or less, you know, some humans have better or worse ethics, right? So the fact that there's degrees of any of these things, even in the natural world, you can find a hierarchy, higher orders of life forms, lower orders of life forms, anything hierarchical in terms of degree. His argument is that, well, anywhere you see degree, there has to be a greatest degree in order to define those degrees. We already kind of spelled out the argument. And so God, kind of in parentheses, by definition for Aquinas, is the maximum degree of all of these attributes that are praiseworthy, whether it's power, whether it's knowledge, whether it's complexity, whether it's infinity, whether it's, you know, long lifespan, you know, eternal versus a finite lifespan, whatever it is, God is the one, is the being that has all of those attributes. So it's a slightly different argument because he's not saying that God exists by definition in terms of the definition of perfection, but he is saying that the concept of infinity, having the greatest degree of any of these attributes, it, you know, only one being can have those attributes. Everything else that has a lower degree is defined in terms of the greatest degree of those attributes. So perfection would be, you know, if you have goodness, then perfection would be the greatest degree of goodness or something like that goes the argument. Is it a very convincing argument? Well, I don't think so. I think, you know, in this world where we know about the mathematics of infinity and we know about, you know, space being infinite and vast, and we know about these endless quests to better ourselves that don't seem to require perfection as an end goal, I don't think those arguments are very convincing, especially in universe, I think. But, you know, nonetheless, those are the important arguments in the history of philosophy as it relates to perfection. Now, what does that mean for the Bork? You know, I think it's no accident that the concept of, I guess my point in going through those arguments is not to sort of say these are good arguments. I think they're largely bad arguments. The reasoning fails for all the reasons we've already mentioned. I think culturally, what's interesting is the way in which the concept of perfection is related to some sort of a spiritual life. Yes, these philosophers are trying to use reason to try to prove God's existence, but, you know, largely they are people who have a Judeo-Christian spiritual worldview. And the Borg, you know, however much they might, whatever words they might say about their quest for perfection, Seven of Nine has this kind of spiritual reverence for the Omega molecule and this quest for perfection. However bad the arguments are, however insincere the Borg queen might be in her motivation about seeking perfection, Seven of Nine inevitably conflates relates the notion of perfection to this molecule to some sort of spiritual component. And I think this concept of perfection is it's hard to separate it from the divine in some way. That's where the rubber meets the road. You know, if there's a divine, then that's where the concept of perfection is going to come into play. Anywhere in the physical world, anywhere in the human world, we're not dealing with perfection. We're dealing with imperfect people and finite lifespans, and perfection is not our day-to-day routine. And same thing for the Borg. You know, that's not something they have achieved. All their talk for questing after perfection, they haven't achieved it. So it represents this ideal that you know, whatever it is, you know, perfection for the Borg, I think, and undoubtedly means something different than it does for, you know, in-universe humans in Starfleet. And that means something probably different for us here today. But it does represent this unachievable end goal that you're striving after, but likely to fail. And I think that's an inherently if it's not a full blown religious concept, it's at least a spiritual one.
I think Thomas Aquinas, in his argument from degree, I think he was onto something personally. This idea that there are different degrees of intelligence and so on and so forth, and so therefore there must be, as it were, there must be a perfect end goal, a perfect being at the top of that hierarchy. I think there's something to be said for that. And again, whether our listeners subscribe to the Judeo-Christian worldview or not, we live in a society that is on a quest for perfection. And again, I reference what I said in my initial statement just about, you know, for instance, the supplement industry, the beauty industry. These industries are thriving today because of humanity's quest for perfection. But even in the scientific world, there is an incredible push to understand this universe in its most basic terms. And we've identified a particle, you know, we even call it the God particle because we feel like it has certain properties. And I know I'm paring this down to its simplest terms, but Zachary, we could go a whole other hour and talk about, you know, what we've discovered in this particle. But paring it down in its simplest terms, we believe that this particle has the potential for that spark, if you will, of divinity that really kind of threw the whole universe into being. So there's even this scientific quest for understanding perfection and attaining perfection and understanding the power and understanding the knowledge for Seven of Nine. You know, even Janeway questions that. She asks Seven of Nine, listen, is this a theory that you have or is this a belief? She was trying to make the distinction, you know, is this a scientific theory or is this something that you're solely, you know, chasing on faith? And to some degree, you know, Seven of Nine tells Chakotay that, you know, hey, I'm no longer Borg, but I still need to understand perfection. And she says, without it, my existence will never be complete. And she tells Janeway that, you know, hey, we came across this molecule through assimilation. It began with this species. They were primitive, but, you know, their oral history referred to a powerful substance that could burn the sky. The Borg became intrigued. That led us to another species. They were primitive as well, but they believed, and here's this interesting little twist, they believed it was a drop of blood from their creator. You know, and so there's this creation story that's part of it. So it all kind of goes in and forms this mythos. And I'm curious, and perhaps there's some fanfic out there, but you know, I'm curious as to, you know, at what point did the Borg Queen say, "Oh, this is really fascinating. It's this destructive particle. It kind of represents everything I'm trying to do here, where I'm just going to go out and assimilate everything in the galaxy, and I alone am going to be the head of it."
Mike, I'm glad you thought to mention the Higgs boson, or what is colloquially known as the God mm-hmm. particle. On the one hand, I think it's a really terrible nickname for this particle, because I think the concept of calling something a God particle, it's such a laden... Yes. concept, right? It brings so much conceptual baggage and emotional baggage for a lot of people into something that is largely just a physics
concept. I use the term because I think most of our listeners would probably relate to it as opposed to the Higgs boson.
Absolutely. And so I think it's a terrible name because it unnecessarily brings a lot of emotional import into the discussion about the particle. I don't think it needs to be there. On the other hand, I think it's actually a really accurate name because in Judeo-Christian theology, God serves this sustaining role in sustaining creation, mm-hmm. right? That if in absent God, all of creation just would go away, right? There's nothing to sustain its existence. And so the idea behind the Higgs boson, again, there's always the danger when philosophers talk about physics that, you know, we're going to overreach and talk about things we don't really understand. And any physicists that are really out there are going to say, oh my God, these philosophers on Metatrex, they don't have any idea what they're talking about with this Higgs boson particle. I'm going to risk it anyway.
Yeah, because we're not here, as I said before, Zachary, we're not here to really break this thing down in any substantive way. But it is relevant to our discussion.
Well, I think, as I understand it, again, this is kind of the layman's standpoint, right? As I understand it, the Higgs boson was originally a postulated entity that was necessary to explain some other things we already knew about the nature of particle physics. And if this particle didn't exist, you wouldn't be able to explain the existence of a bunch of other things we already knew about. And that's how it was first postulated, wasn't able to be verified. Eventually, just recently, a couple years ago, they ended up verifying the existence of the Higgs boson particle, kind of proving, mm-hmm. you know, the way that the these particles relate to each other and all, but this kind of sustaining role, the Higgs boson being necessary to explain the existence of these other things that we already know exist. That is where I think the term God particle is actually really an interesting apt name, because God in the Judeo-Christian worldview sustains creation. The Higgs boson is necessary to explain the existence and the sustained existence of these other particles. So it's analogous, and it actually is a really interesting, good analogy, but it just smuggles so much conceptual baggage into it. I think it's a kind of an unfortunate name at the same time, but it is, I don't think you get any theoretical physicist worshiping the Omega molecule or imbuing it with spiritual powers or viewing it as a symbol for the divine. And I think that the divide between science and religion is largely artificial and largely fueled by the media. Sure. And fueled by popular discussion. There are a lot of scientists who are religious and scientists who have a theological worldview. And the battle between science and religion was never as fierce as people like to portray it, even at its worst, mm-hmm. I think. And nonetheless, I don't think you get any theoretical physicist using that particle as a symbol for anything as grandiose as the Borg concept of perfection. So I'm not sure what we can learn about the Borg from the analogy to the God particle here in the real world. It's an interesting parallel, because you end up with a particle that is an important entity in one way or another. It serves some sort of theoretical role. The term God particle, I think it did get that nickname for a reason. It does seem to have the significance for some people. But I think that the term God particle is largely a term that's fueled from the outside as a criticism, not something sure. that it, from the inside that is viewed with the kind of genuine spiritual reverence that you see in Seven of Nine about the Omega particle. So I'm not sure the analogy really holds up, but it's the best actual analogy to the real world, I think. We do have this particle that is important in theoretical physics. We call it the God particle for God's sakes. And is it a good analogy? I don't know if we can really learn anything from it. I think largely it's not a great name, and I don't think anyone really views it that way. So I don't think it's a great analogy, but we'd be, again, it's one of these things we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it, but I'm not sure we can learn anything terribly interesting.
Oh, sure. I agree. But I will say that for those who are very invested in the scientific community, it does represent something significant. It does represent a scientific understanding that transcends to some degree the mythos, if you will, or what they view as a mythos. This is something that transcends that and begins to pull into, at least in scientific terms, a greater understanding of what is holding the universe together, and possibly something that could have been present and active in the creation of the universe as it is.
It's funny we speak in these terms, because even when we're having the theoretical physics discussion, you can't help but smuggle in the religious analogy.
It's difficult.
Like I was catching myself about to say, and I'm going to say it right now, but I was catching myself about to say the holy grail of physics is the grand unified theory, trying to unite particle physics with relativity sure. theory and combining these into a coherent view. And so right now we've got gaps. We've got things that don't seem to add up. We've got missing, holes mm-hmm. in the theories that aren't explained. And the Higgs boson is one of the big unexplained things, at least in particle physics, right? How that matches up with relativity theory on a larger macro scale, that's still an open question. How to take these two seemingly different accounts of reality and put them together in a coherent way. But I think you're right. There are, insofar as the Higgs boson was this missing puzzle piece to complete at least one segment of a grand unified theory, to kind of unite mm-hmm. particle physics in a way that it hadn't been as coherent before, it certainly is something to strive for. I don't think anyone would say it's not something worthy of striving towards. If one of the things we can do as rational beings, even if you're religious, if we're created in the image of God to be rational beings, we should use our minds to increase our knowledge. And that's something that's, praiseworthy, I think, almost on almost any worldview. Right. So, I guess I wouldn't want to be accused of criticizing you know, anyone for seeking to increase knowledge, for seeking to better themselves. It's just that I think it's the term God particle just overly spiritualizes it. Yes, it's a praiseworthy quest. It's an important missing theoretical piece. People have dedicated their entire life's work to trying to find it. You know, and, you know, some of that work has been accomplished, and that's great. You know, clap our hands. Yay, scientists, yes. Right? But so what? At the end of the day, there are other pieces that need to be verified or falsified. There are, you know, different theories that need to be either rejected or pieced together in some way. You know, the quest goes on. I guess that's, you know, at the end of the day, I think that's where you are with questing for perfection. You never quite get there. There's always something else to do. There's always something else to learn. There's always a way to better yourself, no matter how much you've accomplished, no matter how much you've improved yourself or improved your species. And I think in the Star Trek universe, this is really interesting. Humanity from now in the 21st century to there in the 23rd or 24th century, I think undoubtedly you can say there have been improvements. I think any Star Trek fan worth his or her salt would say there are some improvements in humanity in the world we see in Star Trek in the 23rd and 24th century. Great. So what? The quest goes on, right? What about the 25th century and the 26th century? You know, plenty of those characters inside the Star Trek universe have character flaws and faults, and they make mistakes just like we do, right? So the quest goes on. No matter how much you better yourself, there's always more work to do. And no matter how much you learn, there's always more to learn. No matter how much your theory seems to explain reality, there's always another criticism. There's always another piece of evidence. There's always another counterexample. The quest, same thing with philosophy. No matter how much we think we've progressed conceptually, you know, we've defined formal logic. We didn't have that back in ancient times, right? We have the scientific method. We didn't have that a few hundred years ago. You know, these are improved conceptual tools, but so what? It's not like we can say we're done, we've achieved the goal, and, you know, wrap it up with a bow and call ourselves perfect, right? The quest goes on. And I think that's my end of the day take, maybe my final thought, since we're creeping up on over an hour here. I think my final thoughts for the discussion are just like, so what? Even if the concept of perfection is a substantive concept, it doesn't mean we're ever going to achieve it. It doesn't mean the quest ends. Life goes on. The quest goes on. The quest for knowledge, the quest for betterment. I don't think the concept matters as much in a practical sense for what we should do. We should keep striving. We should keep improving. We should keep learning. And at the end of the day, the quest goes on. That's my end of the show soundbite for my final thoughts. The quest goes on.
You're exactly right when you say that there are gaps. And I think Star Trek recognizes that there are gaps. And it's fascinating in the conversation that Catherine Janeway has with Seven of Nine. It goes back to the question she asked her. Is this a theory? She says, what is it the Borg say that Omega is perfect? Seven of Nine says, yeah. And Janeway says, is that a theory or a belief? Are you thinking like a scientist, or are you just going on faith? And what you have here in this episode are science and religion, really in a very superficial way, disagreeing. You have Catherine Janeway's science and Seven of Nine's faith. And I think that's really fascinating. And I said in a very superficial way, because at the end of the day, was the particle dangerous? Yes. Is there something in that particle worth exploring? Was it a metaphor for something worth attaining? Well, certainly for Seven of Nine, and perhaps, you know, a majority of the Borg. I don't pretend to understand if this is obviously something that when she was liberated from the Borg, she took with her, this desire to understand perfection. I can't sit here and say that, okay, every Borg drone has that desire. I think their desires have been muted in favor of the will of the Borg Queen, but that's a topic for another episode. My opinion is the Borg Queen is interested in power, and she is going to, again, assimilate the entire galaxy in order to attain it. I think she used the power that the Omega molecule represented in order to manipulate, in order to motivate, to some degree, the collective. And I think that just as Seven of Nine said, you know, we were told to assimilate it at all costs. I have no doubt that many Borg gave their lives, chasing after this thing in order to try to attain what they perceived as perfection. I think it, to some degree, is a metaphor for what goes on in our own world, in our own society. I think this transcends the Christian community and those who hold to a Judeo-Christian worldview. I think it transcends that. I think it's true of humanity. I think that truth is really foundational in the Star Trek universe because, again, the Federation, their quest is to better humanity, to better the galaxy, to go out and to seek new life and to learn and to grow and to add to, you know, their knowledge and their technologies and their abilities. And so that quest for perfection, if you will, Zachary, sometimes leads to corruption because absolute power corrupts absolutely, and we see it in the Star Trek universe. The motivation behind Starfleet, as I said before, is not so unlike the quest for the Borg. There are many similarities, except, you know, at the end of the day, the Borg are going to go out and take it, and at least from the perception of most people, Star Trek is trying to, or rather the Federation is trying to attain it peacefully. But nevertheless, they're both after the same thing. And so that becomes a metaphor for us finite human beings here on planet Earth. I think that quest for perfection, or, you know, whatever it is that we perceive as being worthy to attain, is a healthy thing. I'm a believer in goals. You know, in the business world, we talk about setting goals and then, you know, going out and taking action steps in order to achieve those goals. What is that, Zachary? But an attempt to attain, you know, perfection. If I can get this many new customers, or if I can drive this much revenue into my company, or whatever it is, that's the goal. This is what we're going after. But as it is in the business world, you attain the goals this year, next year, they're going to set the bar that much higher. So in our own quest for perfection, I think we need to be leery of that concept, because in society, that bar is a sliding bar. What is perfection today? Tomorrow, it's going to be something else. Whether that's, you know, body image, or whether that's academic knowledge, whether that's wealth, power, whatever it is, that bar is always going to move. The thing that differentiates religion, for the most part, is that the bar, in theory, is set. And it doesn't move because it is, you know, this end goal. But that goal is unattainable. Perfection is unattainable, Zachary. And that doesn't stop anyone from trying. I think it's all about the journey.
Well, Mike, I'm fascinated because I think we reached a place in the discussion that I find interesting and I didn't expect to go when I came into the show today. I think at the end of the day, we've come to see that the quest for betterment is inherently a good thing, but we should be a little skeptical of the concept of perfection. Look at the many ways that the concept of perfection can be misused, mm-hmm. right? It can be used to manipulate other people, right? You can tell someone they're not perfect enough, not good enough, not whatever, and motivate their behavior through guilt, through these cult-like approaches to things, right? When the concept of perfection comes into play here in the human world, it's usually someone manipulating or someone being manipulated.
I mean, look at the Nazis in the 30s. I mean, the Aryan movement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was a quest for Aryan perfection.
Right, exactly. That's exactly the kind of thing I have in mind, right? The concept of perfection can be misused to achieve any number of really terrible things, and it's often done intentionally by someone wielding power strings. So, just like the Borg mm-hmm. Queen, it's a perfect analogy. That said, I think, you know, our listeners out there are going to be from any number of different worldviews and belief systems, right? Some people are going to have a Judeo-Christian worldview. Some people are going to have a worldview of other religions. Some people are going to be atheistic, and so on. If you have a religious worldview, the concept of perfection is possibly built into your worldview. If you already have a theological worldview, you can't help but have incorporate the concept of perfection into your worldview. If you think of God as a divine being that's perfect, that has all these omniscience and omnibenevolence and whatnot, then kind of by definition, perfection is built into your worldview. You can't avoid it. It's just that you need to be careful of transferring that to the human sphere. Because whenever you take that concept and transfer it to the human sphere, try to be more perfect. You aren't perfect enough. Let's try to make humanity a little more perfect, just like those Nazis. You know, you get really terrible consequences. And so, in my mind, perfection should stay in the divine, and we should be comfortable living down here in our imperfect human sphere, and never the two shall meet. You know, if you try to achieve perfection too much, you're going to disappoint yourself. You're going to do some bad things. That said, you know, on an ethical view, if you have a theological religious worldview, that view towards perfection can be a compass needle that hopefully orients your ethical thinking to achieve something good rather than being misused like the Nazis did with their concept of perfection, or the Borg Queen with her concept of perfection. So, but it's a slippery slope, and it's a fuzzy line, and it's very easy to go from, you know, a pure motivation to an impure motivation. So I think it's largely a dangerous concept here in the human sphere. And that's an interesting, angle on the discussion of perfection that I hadn't intended to talk about when we started the show today. So I think I've learned something. I hope you learned something too. But perfection and the Borg aren't the only things we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere around the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You know, Pushing Daisies and Hannibal are two very different shows, but they both have a very strong visual look and a very strong storytelling style and a point of view. And one is quirky, and one is darkly quirky, and one is whimsically quirky.
Standard Orbit.
Just across the board, it gives you space adventure because they go to the galactic barrier. It gives you the personal dilemma, which is what Star Trek's all about, exploring the human condition. And it gives you just a fun action adventure as well. So just great entertainment.
The 602 Club.
With the idea of putting your faith in a lie, what do you put your faith in, and is it strong enough to hold it? What they're asking Gotham to put their faith in is a lie. And the moment, again, it comes out, it's not going to be good. And that always struck me as something that's going to be really interesting.
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions. And that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @TrekFM.
You can also find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, be sure to check out The Babel Conference. That's our listeners-only discussion group. Just type The Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook. It's a closed group, but if you click and ask to join, we'll let you right in. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not hanging pictures of the Omega Molecule on your podcast studio walls, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, certainly on Facebook, that's where I'm most active. Also around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not assimilating your way to academic perfection, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you'd like to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. And Mike, we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers for MetaTreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. And we'd like to thank Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
Well, I don't know. There's a connection there. Dwayne Johnson and Seven of Nine going at it.
That's true.
Mono and
I
mono.
I could talk about wrestling, you know, for a long, no problem for hours. I could do a wrestling podcast for sure.
See, was Dwayne Johnson the only wrestler to ever make an appearance in Star Trek?
Oh, that is a good question. Let me think.
I think so.
I feel like I'd know about it if there was another one.
But see, those guys are perfect to play alien species. I think if I'm Rick Berman, you know, my alien of the week is going to come right out of the WWF.
Mm-hmm. Really? I can't believe there haven't been any more. Is that, wow. I mean,
I think that's the only one. And seriously, well, I mean, what a shame. Why not take those kind of verbose personalities, put some latex on their face and have some fun?
Absolutely. They can totally do that. That's what they do anyway. Right?
Yeah, they do it anyway. Why not?
Dress themselves up in their costumes and become their characters. Sure.